is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. The Silver Bullet Security Podcast is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. You can get information about the podcast at www.computer.org/security or www.cigital.com. This is the fourth in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm happy to have with me today Dana Epp. Hi, Dana.
Hey, how you doing?
Dana is the CEO and founder of Scorpion Software. He's a software security aficionado, a respected blogger, a jazz trumpet player, and a Canadian, eh?
That's right.
He lives in the Great White North, and he lives on the net as Sylvester, or is it Silverster?
Silverstar.
Ah, Silverstar. I never knew.
Like a general.
Like a general.
There you go.
His blog, which is well worth checking out, is available at URL silverstr.ufies.org/blog. So Dana is an international man of mystery, and when I first came across Dana, I wasn't sure whether Dana was a man or a woman, sort of the Pat effect. And we'd never spoken in real time, but I'd had a fair amount of email with him. So this is going to be quite an adventure doing a podcast. So off we go. What do you say?
I said, let's go do it.
All right. You're a longtime software security practitioner, I guess about 15 years or so,
yep.
And a strong advocate for building things properly. How'd you get started in software security?
Oh, started in software security. Well, I fell upon it when I was a kid, actually. In the old days of bulletin boards, I was building systems. I don't know if you remember back in the late 80s of a thing called remote access.
Yeah, absolutely.
DOS-based bulletin board system. I built a couple of security auditing systems that were being used by government agencies for managing file access. So being able to, when people would do dial in, to be able to do dial backs and be able to check what they were up to and see what files they needed access to, and of course if they have authorization to do so.
So that's kind of a security features based way to get started, I guess.
Yeah, and that was basically how I got started, except that quite frankly, looking back on it now, was very pathetic in the fact that I didn't know how to design things securely. Because I remember one day I was going to take a look at some of the assembler I wrote, and I was just shaking my head and going, what the hell was I doing? And that's because back then there was no such thing as designing secure software.
You know, the same thing happened when I was working on building secure software with John Viega. We went back and looked at some of the mailman code that he had released, and it was just a disaster from a security perspective. And it's funny to go back once you've learned some things about software security and see what your code looks like from ancient times.
Yeah.
You know, code lives forever.
Oh, and isn't that the truth? And it's really interesting because we start seeing that more and more in the commercial space, because there's still applications that have been running 10, 15 years that, you know, they work quite well for what they were designed to do. They just weren't, people weren't thinking about the attack space that we're going to change and how our whole mentality and where we are on the internet was going to change. Well, think about it. The whole internet itself was not designed to be secure, and now we run everything on top of that.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of an accident of a radical change in environment, I guess.
Yep.
And so even people who thought reasonable thoughts about their security environment when they built something, let's say they were building it for a proprietary network, then they put it on the internet, things have just changed so much that you really need to take a close look at it again.
Yep.
So how do you feel about progress in software security? Are there any major highlights or turning points or things that you've seen in the last 15 years?
Well, you know, for me, I actually think it's been the last 5 years that real progress has occurred. You know, there's been lots of research, I would say, starting, you know, maybe 10 years ago that we're starting to see it being applied. But what really, to me, was the tipping point where things started to change was when people just started saying, you know what, Windows 95 and things like that, it's not acceptable. It's crap, and what are we going to do about it? And people started thinking and talking about that, and then we actually started seeing people apply that. They were either saying, you know, we're going to build these type of applications, and we're not going to build it on these platforms, and we're going to go do things over here.
Did you see that they recently retired Windows 98 and Windows NE?
They did. You know, we had a little bit of a party online for some of the Microsoft security MVPs, because you know, we're saying it's about time.
Right.
You know, they've even, like, retired XP-SP1, and, you know, it's like, right now, get to SP2 or get off. You know, it's... But what I'd really like to see is that it's kind of weird because we see people like Michael Howard and the crew over at Microsoft actually coming out with things like this whole aspect of the security development lifecycle, which they didn't invent, right? This is like they invented their piece of it, how it works on their system. And we even look at some of the books that you've written where you're showing how at Cigital, like I know I've emailed you and told you how jealous I am that you're able to do that at Cigital. There's been so many different camps that have approached it for their own organizations. We can see, you know, at IBM, we're seeing things at Microsoft, we're seeing things, you know, all across the board. And it all has the same thing, and that is, let's bake security in from the get-go by understanding what risks exist for that platform or what we're trying to build and work from there, which is a way better way than saying, hey, guess what, we just found out about this new type of attack pattern, let's go and try to rectify that, which is never a way to go and build safe software.
I agree with you, and I'm pretty excited about the fact that finally it seems people realize that builders need to get involved in software security.
Yep.
Incidentally, just a little plug for a future silver bullet, Mike Howard will be one of my guests in an upcoming episode. We haven't really scheduled when that's going to be, but happening soon.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because one of the things that I think is happening is a lot of people go and criticize the Microsoft space, and rightfully so. They have such a poor track record. But what they don't know, and when I say they, I'm talking the people that are criticizing that whole spectrum of things, is that they're smart people there. They get it. They know. But you can't just take a big, huge ship and switch it overnight and say, okay, now we're going to design things this way.
Yeah, so it has an 8-bit kernel in the core, kind of like a big albatross hanging around.
But on the flip side of it, I also am very critical of some complexity to security is never a good thing. And one of the things that scares the hell out of me is just how much bigger and more complex a lot of these systems are getting. When you look at things like Vista, you know, like, they've done some really good stuff there. But on the flip side of it, I also know, you know, how large that code base is getting now?
Yeah, it's,
and
how many different totally unwieldy. It's like 60 million lines or something.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like, I remember a couple years ago I was working on a mandatory access control system for Windows. Basically, you think of Crispin's AppArmor, think of something like that for Windows. And I had that all designed out and worked at it was a kernel driver, really good at what it was designed to do. And I started finding all these new attack vectors that I didn't even think about when we're dealing with pathing, because I didn't know that the subsystem of Windows would do things. Like, you can actually set things in the registry for debug mode, where if an executable is called just by name, it can actually execute a different executable.
Right.
And you see this stuff and you're going,
why would they do that?
Why would you do it? Well, because it's a great debugging technique. If something starts up here, we want to load it up in a debugger first, and it makes total sense. But why the heck is it in a production environment in a way that, well, no one knows about it? And what ends up happening is you get egg on your face because it's just so complex.
You know what's interesting is even embedded devices that should be fairly straightforward are getting just as complex. If you look at cell phone code, if you look at the operating systems that are running those things, they're suffering from the same fate. The good news is they're a little bit farther ahead of the curve in terms of consumer expectation and hacking exercises. I think that people that are taking a malicious look at software are much more active in the Microsoft space. It seems like lately they've been focusing a lot of attention on the Office products for some reason.
When we can learn from the failures of all the other vendors, right? So when we see a lot of these people coming into space now, like one thing I really love, especially with things like the SCL list, is that people that are there get it, right? They're in all different walks of life, designing systems for all different operating systems, embedded systems, you know, commercial systems. And what we do know is that the whole aspect of education for security is key, and it's core. And I love laughing about a lot of the things that we see out there, because we see vendors that build network devices or these appliances, and they don't get why us as software security guys seem to be able to get around them all the time, because, well, we have a better understanding of these systems than they do.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, the Matrix when you slow time down.
Yeah.
Just walk right around them.
Yeah.
So what do you think is the most important thing that a developer just getting started in thinking about security can do to make the quickest progress?
Well, I think that they need to go pick up of a couple of critical books, and I think that those books are going to teach them the whole aspect of looking at their application with a little more defense. So, of course, you know, we're plugging you in this one. You know, Software Security is a great book, building secure software, writing secure code. Some of the other ones I like are things like Security Engineering from
Ross Anderson.
Yeah,
that's a fantastic
like those are
book.
Great
yeah.
books because what they do is they get you out of this aspect of thinking. The problem is most people writing software they have the one key critical element that has so much pressure on them that they can't or they believe they can't design secure software, and that is commercial release date. You know, it's a whole aspect of you've got to build this and it's got to be done yesterday. And people don't realize that if they put a little design architecture in place at the beginning, if they front load it with architectural design modeling, you know, they do all these kind of pieces, they'll actually save themselves time, money, and energy later. But they don't know that because they've never been exposed to that. Universities aren't showing them how to do that kind of thing. And look at security, and more importantly, look at the application from a safety perspective or a risk perspective.
Right, yeah.
Quite frankly, I really wish all developers that were designing software had to go through some security training. And I'm not talking about security as in how to write safer code as it relates to things like buffer overflows and things like that. I'm talking about the aspect of understanding what security is about, you know, about least privilege and learning about how, you know, giving just enough access for things that they want. Like, I don't understand when people come out with services now, let's say in the Windows or the Unix spectrum, and they run them as root or they run them as system. It's like, why? What reason? Well, because it's easier. Well, you know what? That's just you being lazy. That's you not understanding that you're opening yourself to new threats that you don't need to do, and it just seems to be useless to be approaching it that way. But people do because they don't know any better.
So let's assume that this developer in question, the imaginary developer we're talking about getting started in software security, has read some of those books and maybe even been to a basic security class. What do you think is the most important best practice that they can adopt the most easily in their own software development lifecycle?
The most easily. Well, I guess part of it would be on the size of the team because I think that may have a big impact on what's there. But I am a big fan of threat modeling. And the reason for that is it's about finding design flaws that could have impact to security mm-hmm. versus implementation bugs, yep. which are things that you'll find with, you know, code analysis tools and pen testing. I know we're talking on that on SCL right now, is that whole aspect of pen testing and your badness meter. And, you know, the whole side of understanding what risks your software is going to have and what, more importantly, what your software is going to touch. The whole aspect of the inputs and the outputs. If the developer can understand and look at those things before they even write a single line of code, they're going to design it better because they're going to understand what kind of mitigating techniques they can put in there to make that safer from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And that's going to save a lot of time because you don't want to try to you can't bolt security on afterwards and make a clean system. It's just really, really difficult to do that. And more importantly, it's just way too expensive. You can't get buy-in from management into designing safer software if they're freaking out because your costs and time delays for all your development processes is just way over budget.
So we talked about some of the issues that you had when you were developing an access control system for a bulletin board system. And we also talked about Viega's mailman fun.
Yeah.
What is the worst thing that you've had happen to software that you wrote ever?
Oh, my arrogance in believing I knew how to design secure software years ago. I remember writing, I guess it would have been about 8 years ago, I wrote a mail server for Windows way before, you know, Exchange was really, I would consider popular from an ISP side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I would do things like think, you know what, I'm going to go and do input validation. So even before everyone was saying, hey, you should do input validation, blah, 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 I was doing things like saying, okay, I'm going to check these buffers and do all this kind of things. And what I was doing was saying, I want it to look like this and do this. And at the end of the day, when we ended up having some vulnerabilities that came from that, I was screaming and going, but I was checking. And what I was doing is thinking that I knew everything and I knew every single attack vector that came out there. And of course, what happened is a canonicalization problem that I didn't even think about or know about. And at the end of the day, it comes down to, I don't know of anybody out there who can say that they're an expert that's not going to be learning tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely.
This
I mean, I remember some of these canonicalization problems that involve rewriting so you can avoid supposedly dangerous characters or, you know, get rid of Unicode or whatever, and they end up growing the buffer so
yeah.
long that it gets too long for the buffer it's supposed to live in.
Or they use a certain escape character set, and you say, okay, I'm going to look for that, and I'll filter that out, and then what they do is create an escape character set to the escape character set, and it goes four deep, and you know, you can't account for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole aspect of, let's just look for, you know, what is proper, and then drop everything else, that's a way better way of doing it.
Yeah,
we all know that now. 8-10 years ago, we didn't know that. So, or at least those who did know that didn't tell me.
So why is it, do you suppose, that security software vendors, that is, people who are creating security software for us, like antivirus products or whatever, don't practice software security?
Ah, because people have two different terms. So many people try putting that together and thinking it's the same thing. Designing secure software is not the same as designing security software. And the people that write security software 9 times out of 10 are developers like you and me. Okay, maybe not like us because we actually care about secure software, but these guys come out and they design. They're good at doing what they do. Like, I know last year I was at a plug fest at Microsoft where a bunch of us kernel mode driver guys got together, and there was a bunch of AV test drivers out there. And I was talking with the developers, and you know, we were talking about things like applying ACLs at the device layer in the kernel and doing things. And they're like, "Well, why do we need to do that?" And it's like, "Well, you don't want just every Tom, Dick, and Harry accessing your IO control stuff." And they're like, "But okay, you know, they're running as administrator anyways." And I'm looking at, they design it from their view of how to get things out.
Yep.
What's funny is we talk to the same people, and they actually have different people designing different systems for what I would consider consumer products and enterprise products. And what we see is that how they approach their designing of code, they see, in at least for some of them, they approach it entirely different. So it seems they get it in the enterprise space, but the consumer space, not so much.
I've also seen that developers are just so optimistic that they, or maybe naive, that they just don't believe that people will do bad things to their stuff.
Yeah.
When you tell them about an attack, or you even show them a real exploit on their code, and this happens to us because we do consulting for a living, and about, you know, 80% of the time they'll say, "Oh, well, you're not supposed to do that," or "No one would ever do that."
Yeah.
And I guess getting people over that understanding would help, but it would be great if the security software people would get some
economic revision
in this area.
It really is. It's unfortunate, but it's the reality. And what I mean by that is that a lot of these systems were designed back in the 95, 98 days, and they ported it forward. I'm kind of happy with things like how Vista's come out, because the whole new driver model and how the things got to get signed and they got to be validated and verified, that's all great and dandy. But at the end of the day, what's really going to make a difference is when customers are screaming and saying, "Enough! Do it right, or don't do it at all." Like, the things that get me, that floor me, is when I hear about things like AV vendors sending out a signature that just destroys the entire network. It locks everything down.
Right.
I remember a couple of vendors where they've sent out signatures, and people have had to go around, even people close to me, I've heard, who have had to walk around and do sneakernet, walk by each machine, reverse back a signature, and reboot each computer manually.
Well, McAfee did this recently,
yeah,
where they removed some critical DLLs from a lot of their enterprise customers.
Yeah.
That was a really serious problem.
Yeah, how are they any different?
I have a question about whether you think regulation can help to address that kind of business need, or at least the demand part of it. I'm thinking about your paper, The 5 Rules of Regulatory Process.
Right.
Do you think that regulation has a decent role in information security? Is it important?
I wish I could say on the surface, yes, that's true, but we've already seen proof that regulation doesn't work. We look at Sarbanes-Oxley as an example of information security practices that are supposed to be deployed in information systems, and they're not working. And they're not working because people aren't adopting them the way that they should. And so they get huge cost overruns, and you know, I don't know if regulatory compliance issues will resolve things at the software level until there's some way to associate a pain to those vendors. In other words, they either become liable for some of these issues, or there are some sort of repercussions for not doing things the way they're supposed to.
So we've actually, in our practice, which involves working with a lot of large financial houses, especially the New York guys, seen Sarbanes-Oxley at least make people aware of how much they were relying on their software and how big that pile was.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a good thing. It's sort of a side effect.
Right.
That led them to say, "Oh, my God, we seem to be a software house instead of a bank, and so I guess we should get involved in software security." And a lot of them are trying to do that right now, which is good. But that's not a direct effect of regulatory pressure.
That's right. And the other thing to that is that whenever someone forces you to do something, there's always going to be resistance. You can't get buy-in properly into something if they're being forced to do it. You know, you look at some of these compliance regulations, and you see how much cost is associated with that. And immediately that gives a resistance barrier. And whenever you have that, that makes adoption of security very difficult, because they're just going to look and go, oh, God, we got to do this because of this compliance. We've got to do this and this, and we're wasting all this money, and we don't see any benefit to that. And there's where in lies the problem,
right.
Is until people can realize the benefits of secure systems, they're not going to see what the outcomes are. And what I mean by that is that if they could actually start, look, use banks as an example. Yeah, they've had to, you know, there's been a compliance regulation that's been in place, and now we start seeing things even, I think it's by the end of 2006, high sensitive transactions require multi-factor authentication.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened last week? Oh, all of a sudden there's this new phishing attack, which is doing a man in the middle, dealing with two-factor authentication tokens, and now the world's screaming, oh no, the thing's ending. And it's like, well, you have to understand what risks are being offered and being mitigated.
When you squeeze the balloon, the air is going to go somewhere.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I don't like quoting Bruce all the time we say this, but this whole aspect of security as a process and not a product is really key. But I take that further and say that security is about risk mitigation, not risk avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're designing software, be it in relation to something that is in the InfoSec space, or just, you know, your word processor, at the end of the day, you need to make sure that it's going to deal with the risks that are really appropriate. Yeah, we're not going to be able to go and say things like, hey, you know, this guy's going to go do this, he's going to have access to your machine, he's going to be able to poke into the memory and do this and that. Okay, that's not practical, but when you have things like, you know, accounting software that's out there that you cannot run with least privilege, must be run as administrator, and all the account information is not encrypted on disk, so anybody can open it up in a notepad and get your social security number, there's a problem.
Yeah, the basics. So I wanted to ask you a couple of non-security related questions.
Sure.
The first is, what books are you currently reading that are non-security related? I know if we can look on your blog and tell what technical books you're reading, and that's a really cool aspect of your blog, actually. But what non-security books are you reading?
Well, I am an entrepreneur by trade as well. So, you know, I own my own small business, and so I read a lot of business-related books. And I just finished reading a couple of micro-ISV books that were written by Eric Sink, and which I thought were kind of interesting because it came from his old blogs kind of stuff, and rereading actually a bunch of books on EMIF. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it's a business process that businesses can apply.
Yeah.
And so I've been spending a lot of time doing that. What's funny is I don't read a lot of fiction. The last fiction book I read would have been a couple of years ago, actually, and that was Cryptonomicon, which is a great book. But
It was a tome, even.
But I just haven't had time. I actually was kicking myself because I wanted to read The Da Vinci Code before I went and saw the movie, and I never did.
That's all right. It sucked.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But I just don't have time. I spend so much. Like, I have, 450 security blog RSS feeds I read on a pretty regular basis. Uh-huh. And, you know, between that and the research I'm doing and some of the teaching that I'm doing, I just don't have time to read.
So another question. What is better, in your opinion, Sketches of Spain or Tutu?
Now, where would you bring that question from?
I figured you'd have an opinion on it.
I have no opinion.
You have no opinion?
I have no opinion.
You like all miles?
That's right.
Oh, man. Come on. Surely you can differentiate your miles.
You know what's funny is, actually, have you ever listened to Bitches Brew?
Yeah.
What's your favorite track on that?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
Neither
answer.
Do I. Here's the problem. I'm a great fan of people like Miles Davis, but when someone goes and tells me, what's that song? I have no clue. I have no clue. You know, actually, my favorite trumpet player right now, which surprises me, but is actually Chris Botti. And it's because he's a guy that's young, he's got a lot of energy, and he's putting in some very interesting riffs into his music, and I really love it, and I'm hoping someday I can listen to him live.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Hey, well, you know what? It's great. Thanks for giving me a call.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by IEEE S&P Magazine and Sigil. If you go to www.computer.org/security/PSI-sub, you can subscribe to IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. In addition, at sigital.com/silverbullet, you can find show notes, links, and an online discussion forum for this podcast. This is Gary McGraw.